In one of the national newspapers, it says apparently that Christmas is not good for us. Britons are left overwhelmed and stressed by the festive period. The subheading there says, it's meant to be the most wonderful time of the year, but the sheer panic and pressure of Christmas leads to extra accidents and injuries, plus a whole load of extra stress. And I'm not sure how true it is, but it says that the research found around 20% of people find the experience of Christmas completely overwhelming. This must be true. It was in the newspapers, so it must be. Apparently, I'm not sure there's a gender imbalance here. A third of women, apparently, feel more stressed throughout December than any other month across the year. I'm not sure. We could take a bit of a poll, but we're not going to here. I don't want to get myself in hot water. You may buck the trend yourself. On top of the stress, actually, Christmas apparently makes us particularly accident-prone as well. One in 10 spill burning hot fat on themselves when dealing with roast potatoes or turkey, while nearly 20% cut themselves prepping the veg. I assume that's accidental, not just sheer frustration with the whole thing. Now, I'm not sure about this one. Apparently, 600,000 people have burnt themselves roasting chestnuts. I don't know who they are, but I don't think any of them live in Yate. We don't go in for that, of course, that way. Apparently, Christmas decorations can be particularly hazardous as well. According to the study, 3% of people suffer an electric shock due to badly wired Christmas lighting. And one in 50 fall out of the loft trying to get the tinsel and baubles done. The research also shows that 500,000 people have had a gas leak over Christmas. Well, I think we've had one here this morning. I don't know where that went. Anyway, it can be a stressful time, can't it? It can be a time when we rush around doing all kinds of things which we wouldn't even consider doing the rest of the year, but suddenly we feel constrained to do it at Christmas, which, of course, is a very strange contrast and paradox in a time that's supposed to be celebrating the Prince of Peace. We seem to get most frantic when we're celebrating the coming of the Prince of Peace, which is a bit bizarre when you stop to think about it, isn't it? Those verses from, well, that verse from Isaiah, which calls Jesus the Prince of Peace, or the biblical word, the Hebrew word is shalom. And it says, when he comes, there will be no end to shalom, no end to peace. And somehow we managed to celebrate his coming, Advent, and particularly Christmas, and suddenly there is a distinct end to peace. It all seems back to front somehow. And that word shalom, that biblical word shalom, is very rich and deep and almost impossible to capture with one English word. The word peace doesn't really do it justice. At the root of the word shalom is to make something complete or restored or whole, so that there's nothing missing and nothing broken. I wonder if that's how our hearts are around Christmas time. Nothing missing and nothing broken. Shalom. When Jesus comes, we're told, he will bring into existence a world and individual lives where there's nothing missing and nothing broken. That is surely worth celebrating at least once a year. And there's an intriguing little story we're going to just reflect on briefly this morning, which kind of contrasts, in one sense, although it wasn't written for this reason, it kind of contrasts these two attitudes to Christmas. The franticness on one hand, and that sense of shalom and peace on the other hand. And it's the story of Jesus visiting Martha and Mary. As Jesus and the disciples continued on their way to Jerusalem, they came to a certain village where a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Her sister Mary sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he taught. But Martha was distracted by the big dinner she was preparing. She came to Jesus and said, Lord, doesn't it seem unfair to you that my sister just sits here while I do all the work? Tell her to come and help me. I love that. But the Lord said to her, my dear Martha, you're worried and upset over all these details. There's only one thing worth being concerned about. Mary has discovered it, and it will not be taken away from her. Isn't that quite a saying? There's only one thing worth being concerned about, and Mary has discovered it. I love that. And there's the contrast that's often drawn between those two sisters. And often what we are led to reflect on is that Martha is kind of the frantic worker. She's the one that's spinning all the plates, making sure that everything's ready, turkey's in the oven, the potatoes, all that stuff. Frantically working away, trying to impress or to fulfill some goal. Whereas Mary is the quiet worshipper sitting at Jesus' feet. And often what's been drawn from this is a contrast between two whole ways of life, between the activist doer on the one hand and the still worshipper on the other hand. And whole ways of life have been formed on people feeling called to the contemplative life, sort of leaving aside normal daily life and entering some kind of monastic or contemplative order following the pattern of Mary. But is that really the contrast that's being made? Is it really saying that work is bad, worship is good? Which is sometimes the sort of simplistic way it's been set up. Certainly what we see in the story is we see Martha as the hassled host. She wants to get everything right. I wonder, you know, it's easy to be critical perhaps, but I wonder if Jesus came to your house for dinner, what might you assume you had to do to get ready? Well, I don't know. So you're not looking like, you're not even thinking about it, are you, really? You're not, I hadn't really thought about it, really. I don't know what to do. But I know when people come to our house, I kind of feel a little bit of an obligation inside, rightly or wrongly, to kind of get the place ready for them. And I make assumptions about the kind of house that they want to come into. They want it to be tidy and clean, and they want to have nice food, and they want to have a piece of cake with a cup of tea. And, you know, you start making assumptions about what your guest wants. And then you rush around trying to fulfill it. And depending on how much of a tip your house normally is, that's either harder or easier and makes it more or less likely that you're going to invite people around, because the pressure of getting things ready is that much greater if normal is bad. But Martha clearly felt that Jesus expected certain things, and so she was rushing around getting everything ready. Mary, on the other hand, didn't make those assumptions about Jesus. She assumed that Jesus didn't want the perfect dinner and the tidiest house and everything else, but that Jesus wanted her. Jesus wanted her, her attention. And the shocking thing in this story is what it means for Mary to be sat at the feet of Jesus. Because Mary was not worshipping Jesus. That's the mistake that's often made in that former way of thinking about it. Mary is not a worshipper. To sit at the feet of a rabbi is to be a learner. That's what it means to sit at the feet of Jesus. It doesn't mean to sit in rapt, worshipful attention. It means to sit as a learner. Paul described his own education as being sat at the feet of Gamaliel. To sit at the feet of a rabbi is to sit in the position of a learner, and here's the even bigger shock, in order that one day you might become a rabbi too. Now, in the culture of those days, when even the house was physically divided between the bit that the women normally worked in and the bit that the men spent their time in, here was Mary in the men's bit of the house, learning, possibly so that one day she herself could be a rabbi. It was unheard of. It was countercultural to the extreme. And that's perhaps why Martha was so upset. She didn't even be in this room. Tell her to come and help me. Send her back to the kitchen where she belongs. But Jesus didn't. He said, no, there's only one thing. There's only one thing worth worrying about. And Mary's discovered it. The thing that Mary discovered is the one thing that's worth worrying about is paying attention to Jesus. See, Martha's mistake was that she thought she needed to get the house straight for Jesus. She made all kinds of assumptions about what it meant to be right for Jesus. And then she ordered her life in such a way that the house would be right for Jesus. Whereas Mary's insight was that she knew that you need to listen to Jesus to know what sort of house he wants. Can you see what I'm saying? That actually we can make all kinds of assumptions about how Jesus wants our lives and what we should be doing and what's normal. And particularly around Christmas time, what we need to do to be normal. And Mary knew that she didn't know what normal was until she'd spent time sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening and being taught. See, Mary and Martha had both had teachers. Martha had been taught by her family, her culture, and ultimately her own heart, what it was to have guests in the house. She'd learned from her Jewish culture. She'd learned from her family. She'd learned from watching others. And somehow she'd taken all of that learning into herself so that when someone came into her house, she didn't think, what did my mum and dad do? Or what do they do down the road? But somehow, the way that everybody else did it had got deeply embedded in her own heart. So it was her gut instinct to rush around and get everything ready. She had drunk so deeply from the wells of her culture that actually she couldn't see life any other way than that when guests come in, you rush around and get everything ready. Mary, on the other hand, had clearly begun to learn that Jesus had different priorities to the world that she'd grown up in. Different priorities, maybe, to her parents. Maybe different priorities to the ones that naturally she found in her own heart. Because Mary had begun to listen to Jesus for her normal. Who defines normal for you? Who defines the way things happen? What's expected for you and for me? It's so easy to be shaped, particularly around Christmas time, by our culture, the way we've grown up, what the parents did, what it was like at home. There may be good things. I'm not saying it's all rubbish by any means. But some of the pressure can sometimes come from that kind of inbuilt desire to be normal. But when normal is somewhat mad, being normal may not be all that desirable. What we find at Christmas time, as in fact many times of the year perhaps, is that when we've been shaped by our culture and by our families and by what's in our own hearts, we get pulled in all sorts of different directions because we're trying to keep so many different people happy all the time. That's hard, isn't it? Trying to keep people happy. And we need to keep people happy because something inside us feels good when we've made people happy. So we try and keep that person happy with that kind of meal, and that kind of person happy with that kind of gift, and that person happy with that kind of attention. And we're pulled in all kinds of different directions because we just feel we need, why do we need that? Because deep inside us, we want the attention and the affirmation that other people are giving us. And when our happiness is linked to other people's affirmation, then we're doomed. Because sooner or later, we're doomed. Sooner or later, they won't affirm us enough. They won't like the gift. They won't like the meal. They won't be affirming of us. And something inside us dies. When we're pulled in all kinds of directions, trying to keep that person happy and that person happy and fulfill that person's expectations, whether it's at Christmas or any time of the year, it's not a seasonal affected thing, this. We're in a mess. And what Mary had learned was that actually there is only one person to keep happy. That suddenly simplifies life enormously. There's only one person to pay attention to. There's only one person whose opinion counts. There's only one person who has the right to say to your soul, it's okay. And that's Jesus. And that takes a long time to learn. Sometimes people talk about Jesus as though he's some kind of pill. Come to Jesus and everything will be all right. swallow the pill, and in the morning the headache will be gone. And the truth is that actually coming to Jesus sometimes does that for people. I know people, and you know people, who've instantly come to faith and come to Jesus, and Jesus has touched their life, and they've been radically different. But I suspect we know many more people for whom that's not the case. That actually, the difference that Jesus makes is not a pill, but it's a lifelong program of learning to walk again, of learning to follow, of learning what it means to be human. My father died of a stroke. And 6 months before he died of a stroke, he had a previous stroke. And after that one, he recovered to a degree. But as a 70-year-old man, he had to learn to walk again. And he was on all sorts of medication, but what actually helped him to walk again was the patient work of the physiotherapists who daily picked up this man who had formerly known how to walk and taught him how to go up steps and down steps and all kinds of things. And coming to faith is a bit like that, actually. It's a bit like saying, I need to learn how to live again. I've been living so far, I might even live for 70 years like my dad, but suddenly I know I need to learn again how to live. And that's what Mary discovered sitting at the feet of Jesus, that here's someone who could teach her how to live, not in a frantic way, not in a stressed way, not in a way that's trying to keep everybody happy all the time, but in a new way. Jesus himself put it this way. He said, you're truly my disciples if you remain faithful to my teachings. And then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Can you see the link and flow there? You want to be set free? Brilliant. Jesus can set you free. How do you get set free? By knowing the truth. And what does it mean to know the truth? Well, it means to remain faithful to the teachings of Jesus. Freedom, peace, is as we learn throughout our whole lives how to sit at the feet of Jesus and say, Jesus, how should I do Christmas? I wonder what Jesus would say if we asked him that question. How should I do Christmas, Jesus? Because I'm fed up with getting stressed by all. I don't want to celebrate again the coming of the Prince of Peace with a whole lot of stress. And I wonder if we sit at the feet of Jesus and ask him the question, what he would say. I tried to think in the week. I tried to come up with five clever things that Jesus might have said to finish my talk with. And I couldn't think of a single one. But what I did think was this, that what Jesus might do is what he often did, answer a question with a question and throw the ball back in our court. And if we say to Jesus, Jesus, how can I deal with Christmas? How can I handle Christmas in a way? He might say, well, what are you doing? When you celebrate Christmas, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? And why are you doing it in this way? Is it because the culture have told you to? Because your parents told you to? Why are you doing it this way? Have you sat at my feet and thought about what you're doing and why you're doing it this way? And I think Jesus might have said this, where is your neighbor this Christmas? When you indulge in this celebration of my birth, where is your neighbor? Because Jesus was always concerned about the neighbor. How are you paying attention to them in this celebration, whoever your neighbor is? And of course, Jesus told a well-known story about who your neighbors are. He might say, who are you trying to please? Who are you trying to impress? And why do you need to do that? And he might say, how much is enough? At Christmas time, how much is enough? Enough money to spend. Enough food to eat, enough celebration. And I think, actually, Jesus asking me questions is quite provocative because those don't have simple answers and they don't have the same answer for everyone in the room either. But I wonder if sometimes we need to learn the way of Mary. There's only one thing worth being concerned about, and Mary has discovered it, and it's living the way of Jesus in every circumstance, even Christmas.